Any cat may stare into a fire and see red mice. Welcome to the White Book Podcast, your source for Game of Thrones, the living card game content, formerly known as Two Champs and a Chump. We rebranded for the second edition. I want to give a huge thank you to George R. R. Martin, FFG, and to you, our fans, especially those of you that support us on Patreon. I don't do that enough. We've got big news. I want to make sure it's always in front of people this whole summer. We're hosting nationals in Springfield, Missouri again. This year, they're known as the Grand Championships. We've rented a castle. There's Lord of the Rings. There's board games. There's going to be so much more. Head on over to www.conflictatthecastle.com to find out more. From Melisandre there.
Oh, that was the end of the quote. Holy shit.
Yeah, that was the whole thing. It just made me think about when we're doing these reviews, it's like we're staring into the flames trying to predict how good these cards will be.
Oh my God, Will.
We're just making whatever up.
I thought when you said, like, Melisandre, that you were going to continue the quote, and then they're like, no.
That's it.
Like, whoa.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
I figured that was how I would welcome you back. Make sure you're on your toes, Roy.
I guess. I feel like my recent thing on the White Book, well, before I took my break, was just being bemused by the quotes that you pick.
That's the case most of the time now, since I've basically run out of all the good ones. So now I'm just picking things that personally amuse me. So
you could just like. I think you should just start doing it. Pick like your favorite chapter and just do it sentence by sentence.
that would be great. Let's just start with the prologue of book one. Sentence by sentence, we're going to do a read through of the books. That amuses me more than it should. You know what else amuses me? From the listener's point of view, it's almost like you weren't on break. I've had to like rearrange things with the FAQ and stuff so that. I think this almost comes out to just the normal every other week sort of thing. These bear boxes will come out back to back. I don't know. It won't seem like you've been gone as long as you really have been. So
yeah, it's been like close to a month since I've done an episode. So
yeah.
So I'm happy to be back. I'm Roy, in case you've forgotten my sound of my sing song voice.
I'm Gregory Sean Atkinson. You might know me from Knights of the Hollow Hill and Flea Bottom.
Exactly.
Well, thanks, Greg.
Good to have you back, man. Long time. Long time.
It's been too long.
You know I'm going to just call you Greg now for forever, right?
Oh, no. My heart breaks.
In fact, I'm going to go in and do something, right?
You haven't said... Oh, okay, God. It's in the Lance chat. It's fine. My name is going
to
be changed.
I was about to say, I assume he's changing your name in a Facebook chat.
Because Roy's Facebook chat name is Hot Western Beef Montgomery. So I guess...
Wow. And I thought the Valor Midwest like chat...
Part of that is like names. A joke that they don't even know, really. So the Western Beef part.
Alla told us at the wedding, we were just all drunk, so I don't remember it, but she definitely told us. Are you very, very happy right now?
Yes, I am very, very happy right now. I'm just going to make sure I spell Greg's last name properly.
There you go.
It's on several of your cards. You should be able to figure it out. All right. Instead of listeners waiting for Roy to type in a Facebook chat that they're not in... Why don't we review the non-para cards of the para box?
That sounds brilliant, Aaron. Right. Thank you, sir.
Well, Roy has to go first because you want Lannister and I want Martell.
Oh, Jesus, I have to review these. Give me a minute. All right. So let's start him off with the meme becoming a reality. We have a Botley Crew, which is a non-loyal, three-cost, military icon, three-strength House Botley Raider. Spoiler alert with that House Botley trait here. Reaction, after an opponent collects income, return one gold from that player's gold pool to the treasury. And then we have every captain is a king, which again, non-loyal, like all these out-of-faction cards in the boxes. Two-cost event. Action, until the end of the phase, each captain character you control gains the king trait and does not kneel when declared as an attacker in power challenges. I think that these two cards are pretty narrow in their application. I think Greyjoy is pretty flooded in these the 2-3 drop mono cons that have some kind of marginal to good upside. The one in the box, what is that? Agile crewman or crew person, the one that you can put into play when you play a warship.
Oh,
I think like
eager deckhand.
That I think it seems to be the go-to one right now. Maybe in a dedicated choke strategy, this would probably be pretty strong. But I mean, we'll see if those decks take shape with the new cards. But I'm not super sold on this. And then I think for that strategy, it's a firmly like medium B-ish, C-plus B-ish card. And then like every captain is a king is just like even more narrow than that. I mean, there's some good captains, don't get me wrong. But like Greyjoy has so many better cards that would want to run than this. And I mean, if you're building a fun captain deck that you just kind of want to like get people, cool, play this card. But like if you're trying to find the most efficient, you know, 61 Greyjoy cards that you want to play, I don't think this makes anywhere near the cut. So I'd probably give Greyjoy overall like a C, C-ish. Maybe I'm underrating Botley Crew. I mean, on meme potential, it's S tier. But just like as cards you want to actually put in the deck, I think it's firmly like C, C-.
I mean, that really says something about like where the game was when this box was being designed, right? Pre-FAQ, like the FFG looked at Greyjoy and just said, you know what? This box, they're just going to be entirely memes. It'll be fine. Memes and overly literal like translations of cards.
I mean, that's just like Lannister's three boxes in a row's cards, yeah. Right? So during its heyday.
That's fair. But I do at least like Botley Crew theoretically. I don't know. I mean, Choke is one of those many deck types and like styles of play that just flips the switch pretty much instantly from being worthless to being unfun to exist in the game and doesn't have much more than kind of a razor's edge to be in a healthy middle ground. So I almost sort of hope that this does not actually work.
So I tried to tell the Lance chat that Botley Crew might be good. And Wama immediately started yelling at me that there was a first edition card that was cheaper that did this, that actually stole the gold, and shamed me into not liking this card as much. I still don't think it's bad, but I think it's better than he gave it credit for, because it's non-unique, and non-unique seems pretty good for this effect. So, I don't know, I think that's probably like low B range, B minus, let's say. Every captain's a king. I mean, there's things that give you multiple power challenges, right? Like, particularly in Barra, this is because, as always, like, FFG has been telling us for years that Barra and Greyjoy are natural allies. They're bonded by blood.
I'm always confused.
If you can...
Is there a single Barra? There's a couple of smugglers also.
I think so. Isn't Davos, right?
One of the Davoses might be. Give me one second.
So he looks that up.
None of the Davoses are that. Huh. And then smuggler. Oh, I need to look.
Imri Florence? Tell me he's a captain. He is not. He is not.
He's not a power icon. Doesn't Superman.
The reason he has that silly ability to sacrifice locations is literally because he was in charge of the fleet.
Oh.
Ouch.
Well, either way.
Dale Seaworth, Corain, and Salador are the only Vera power icon characters. Yeah. I'm just
so, but there is a Greyjoy attachment that gives Captain trait to things.
Sure.
This isn't great, but the idea is that you can get two or three, given the new Barra locations, power challenges off, right? And it should be relatively easy with one plot to make it three two-claim power challenges. That seems solid, right? Like, it's probably not good, but it's like a Shaga wet dream. So, I mean, look, it's still a D card, but Motley Screw, I gave a B, so I'm going to give the house a C.
Yeah.
Yeah, and about half of the Greyjoy captains are non-loyal, so you could theoretically build a main deck Vera captain's deck.
You just need all that sweet intimidate on Victarion, right? Not kneeling? It'll be great.
Yeah, it's...
All right.
We ready for the next set?
Remember how rare Intimidate was like a week and a half ago? And I was like, who has Intimidate? Everyone.
Turns out it's really good, too. Oh,
that attachment is like my favorite attachment of the game.
Did realize I don't think I actually gave Greyjoy a rating.
Well, mm-hmm. Warhammer?
I'm going to go with a C plus out of this for... all the reasons said before, though I'm not sure we super elaborated on. Motley Crue would have been a lot better if it was released, say, a year to a year and a half ago. We just have a lot more income now.
That's not true. Trade Routes was unrestricted a year to a year and a half ago. You have to go
that's
to
fair. That's fair. That's fair. Yeah.
Economy is a little tighter.
Like 2 years ago, it would have been broken and destroyed the game. But, like, I really wish it just stole the gold. Right? Like, so the treasury sucks. Do let us know, Will. That's your faction.
Okay. So we've got first up Sir Gregor Clegane. He's unique, of course. Four cost this time around. Military and power icons. Six strength. He's not loyal. He's knight and house Clegane. Has intimidate and pillage and then forced reaction. After you win a challenge in which Sir Gregor Clegane is participating, choose and kill a character you control. And then we have a location, the unique Lion Star, also not loyal, 2-cost worship, action, kneel Lion Star to put a Lannister character with printing cost 4 or lower into play from your hand. At the end of the phase, if that card is still in play, discard it from play. I'm probably... more skeptical overall on Lannister here than a lot of people. Both of these are more card disadvantage engines, so to speak, for a house that relies on that and effectively has nothing for in-house draw or actual card advantage.
Time out. It's very important to know. We're going to get to a card later that means that no one has been drawn this game anymore. It's literally not a thing that's possible.
Clegane, I just think, you know, if you desperately need a Clegane, you're probably going core set. I mean, I love Intimidate, as I was just saying, but it's a lot of work to keep up with his ability. There's some fun gimmicky stuff, you know, warding your opponent's stuff, taking their chud with that recruiter for the watch, whatever, and to try to make sure you keep killing your opponent's stuff. But I think that's just cutesy and more work than it's worth. Lion Star, I think, has way more potential. It's a miniature Lannister Harrenhal. You can throw somebody out there, get some surprise challenges. I think it's maybe a little less good than the hype I've been seeing online, though. Just because of Lannister's character base, like they still just don't really have the enters play sort of triggers that Martell or Tyrell or someone else has, so they can't abuse that as well. And the really interesting, like beefy challenge stuff is too big to be put into play with Lion Star. So it's kind of some mid-range challenge dudes. You're going to get it like the 3 and 4 strength range. You're going to maybe get some extra potential by bouncing them back to hand with regents or chambers or something. Or sorry, tower. Dang it. Which is the Lannister bounce location? Yeah, Tower of the Hand.
Tower of the Hand.
Like, I think it has some use, but it doesn't have me like straight up psyched as other folks. So overall, I think I probably only give Lannister like a B minus here, and that's all on the back of Lion Star.
Frigga's not that bad. New Wall is pretty good, and Lannister likes Martell, and Desert Raider likes being dead. So that's not terrible. Gregor should really have to be attacking for his first reaction to happen, and I'd like him a fair amount. That it happens on attack or defense when you don't get the intimidate is kind of shitty. So I think he's probably like a C-. Lionstar is really good. It happens to not be really good in the only good Lannister decks right now, which are generally Shadow stuff. But Lionstar is really good. I think that Lionstar is worth running in like your Clansmini decks. Like, the 2 cost is really, really cheap for what it does. There's enough way to bounce shit. And, like, just being able to have that and Harrenhal out and being able to do both challenges with the Hound without ever paying a gold is pretty nice.
So, Lionstar, I think, you know, I do think that it's good because it makes Lannister look at Flea Bottom a little bit more. And despite my memory being poor, I do think that they've been a bit more aggressive about printing at least decent lower-end Lannister come into play effects. I honestly only know the Lannister card pool in the most glancing of ways. I am well known, it is quite the meme, for my despising of red cards. This is where we need a Jesse Carpenter here who can just rattle off every single Lannister card off the top of his head. But I actually think where you're wrong, though, about this card, Will, is I think it's good in Clansmen. I mean, I'll just defend Jesse's thing. Because, like, a lot of the Clansmen are at that 4, 3 or 4 cost. And it is just, like, a challenge-based strategy that really can use just an ability to get the chain rolling for free or with just, like, a minimum 2 gold reoccurring advantage and has a variety of different ways now to return the cards to the discard pile, or excuse me, from to their hand before they hit the discard pile. So I think Lannister does breathe some life into Lannister, but you know, I still think that Lannister has some way to go. And then Sir Gregor Clegane will never be played in a fair way where the card pool is at the moment. It's just not like the 4 for 6 over, you know, under costed over strength body. It's just not something that card pool's interested in right now. So similar to Mag, although it's not symmetrical like Mag, you will only really play Gregor if you want that kill effect. And so if you do want that kill effect, then he's awesome. If you don't, I think even Lannister's card pool could really just play better cards.
You know, I would love to be pointed at some of those comes into play abilities for Lannister. I've been playing a fair bit of Lannister lately, I like to think, and it's all like shadows and ambush from hand. It's pretty tough. Hey guys, you'll notice a slight difference going forward here. It's just going to be Roy and myself. Unfortunately, Aaron had to go rather suddenly. The perils of being a father. But hopefully Noah is feeling tip-top by the time you guys are listening to this.
Cool.
Yeah. On to Martell.
Not cool, but yeah, we gotta move forward. Ever of a forward, ever onward, I guess. I guess I'll do Martell in honor of our lost comrade. So we've got a 2-cost, non-loyal, non-unique, just an intrigue icon, 2 strength, ally traded Prince's Attendant, which has the marshaling action, kneel Prince's Attendant to reduce the cost of the next Martell, Lord, or Lady you marshal this phase by two. And then we've got Kingsgrave, which is a non-loyal, one-cost, Mimi House Man Woody location, which is a reaction. After you lose a power challenge by five or more strength, kneel and sacrifice Kingsgrave to choose a participating character and return it to its owner's hand. You may kill that character instead if it has the king trait. I mean, I truly wish had not had to leave until after the Martell cards, because I really don't know what to make of these cards. I think Prince's Attendant is the kind of card that would have been like busted in first edition, but may or may not be busted in second edition. And I think it suffers from a little bit of the Martell problem of Martell has just a ton of really good cards that anytime you build a Martell deck, you know, they start off at, you know, 75 cards, even though you're trying to get down to 60 or 61, and you need to trim. But it is obviously going to be powerful in any deck that's trying to abuse like either of the Arianes. But it's still big. It's a big, you know, and it's maybe it's not as bad.
Even
it's
early,
not as bad of a top
if,
deck with
if
the two
you get
strength
to just block
and the
some
green
random
icon.
Combos.
Although I guess the blue, yeah. the power icon on the reducer is better in the later game. I don't know. It's. Do a chump or block something, yeah. Yeah, Martell does love its chump challenges. I think Prince Attendant is a fine, like, I don't know, C plus card. And then Kingsgrave is pretty interesting. I think it falls into that kind of, like, toolboxy Martell location base that is just sort of there. They have these, like, very situational but powerful effects. And if the meta ends up being like truly all about power challenges, particularly crossing, this could be really powerful because, you know, most crossing decks do the power challenge as their third big challenge because they need it to get it up and over your opponent's defenses. And I think that this has the ability to go off consistently. And, you know, the ability to kill a king character or screw a crossing deck's tempo up is pretty powerful. So I would probably put Martell at a reluctant C+, B-, because I might be slightly stronger than that if I'm undervaluing Prince's Attendant, which I will cop to possibly doing. But I think that they are sort of a little toolboxy, a little bit under the curve. But still pretty powerful cards. If they were in any other faction, they'd certainly be busted.
Well, yeah, I mean, any other faction would either be getting a brand new effect for them or have a like wider base of characters to apply the reduction effect to. I mean, I don't know how many new and different thoughts I have here. In a lot of ways, I think it boils down to me that kind of a marginal looking income card at this point, I think, is a little late in the game for me to be like excited and jam into a deck. I think a lot of resource bases are kind of ironed out compared to what they used to be. And we don't have either the abusable effects, like the first edition Gaston Grey, to really try to cycle and abuse replaying these lords and ladies. I mean, just Ariane by herself is maybe not quite there. At least it narrows your ability to get that loop going since it relies just on her. Kingsgrave, I mean, if there's a deck that wants six Gaston Greys, I guess Kingsgrave might have a home. But Gaston Grey is most of the time just always going to be better than this, right? Any challenge and cannot be saved. Yes, I suppose. Oh, sorry, and no strength requirement on Gaston. But I suppose you can sometimes trigger Kingsgrave on attack. Maybe there's a melee deck that wants to run three of each and just dissuade your opponents from ever wanting to attack you.
If you're running just a bunch of these and they're just like, okay, you know, when you're running King's Landing and just, you know, so whichever one an opponent triggers that comes back next turn, like, I mean, I think that's the kind of nonsense you might be able to get away with melee, but melee is still such a degenerate format that I don't know. The one gold is pretty reasonable, though. But, you know, the cost of paying one is that you have to do the win by five or lose by five, I guess. Excuse me. So I don't know. This is the card I'm notoriously bad at evaluating because it has it's powerful, but very, very niche. So the question is, like, how consistently do you think that niche is going to come up? I think we're seeing the Prince's Pass seeing, you know, real constructive play recently. So I would not count out these toolbox Immortelle locations. Just to double back to Prince's Attendant real quick. One of its problems is also, like, a lot of the Martell lords and ladies aren't seeing play.
Sure.
So probably right now the most consistent is actually Quentin. The three drop, right? He's three. The one with renown, as a closer. And then, like, Martell decks don't necessarily need Ahriane anymore. Either of them?
Yeah, he's three.
You know, they're still good cards, don't get me wrong. And, like, if you see a Martell player doing Ahriane BS, like, not like, oh, this person's bad at the game. But it's just, you know, there's just so many other things that Martell can do that are powerful, and they don't rely on that specific character the way in which the decks used to. So maybe this pushes Martell back. Because it makes, you know, the 7-cost Ahriane cost 5, and it makes the 5-cost cost 3, and, like, Ahriane's effect for 3 is just like, whew, okay, I'll take that. You know, and, of course, maybe there'll be a downswing of Vince's in the meta, too, so maybe we'll see. But I still think Prince's Attendant is still not quite where we want to be, but it could be more powerful than we're giving
maybe,
credit for.
Maybe, but...
So anyway, I would give it like a C-ish, C minus, I guess. I probably already rated it. I don't remember.
All right. Yeah. I think C minus is where I was headed with it. So
lay out the Night's Watch.
We shall see. All right. Jeez. It's like, I'm really unprepared for it to just be the two of us here. I'm reading cards again. So much more quickly than expected. So Night's Watch then sends us to Protectors of the Realm. This is a non-loyal, non-unique army. 5-cost military and power icons, X strength, no attachments, and X is your reserve value. Then we also have an event, non-loyal, the Horn that Wakes the Sleepers for 1 gold. Reaction, after an opponent initiates a challenge against you, choose and stand a builder character, a ranger character, and a steward character. You know, I'm really not much feeling Night's Watch in this box. I'm probably okay with that overall. They're really not my favorite faction thematically. But, I mean, in a faction that already has...
The ranging party? This shitty ranger party that we have here?
Ranging party, like, nothing like Protectors of the Realm is just ever going to be playable when you have ranging party to compare it to. Like, if you just need mid-range challenge beef that does nothing else,
straight up better because
you play that.
Well, there's, I mean, I guess no... with pinch around, no attachments except weapon is not straight up better upside than pure no attachments. So, I guess, like, I don't know.
That's fair.
Yeah, this card is just garbage. Unless you're truly abusing, like a 5-for-5 does nothing else army, it's just really not something Night's Watch wants, right? Like, it has probably still down to today the single most efficient beat stick that's not a named character in the game, like non-unique beat stick in the game, which is the ranger party that you mentioned. You know, 4 for 5, no attached mm-hmm. except weapon, is very strong. This is 5 for what? 5? 6?
I mean, probably as a general rule, it's probably 5 for 5. I mean, Night's Watch does at least have a few playable reserve boost cards, so maybe it's 5 for 6, but like at that point, it's constraining other parts of my deck and potentially my plot deck. I'd rather just play a straight up like 5 strength for 4 gold that doesn't place
does
any
literally
constraints otherwise.
Anything except attack and block. Right, because it can't even take any of the like Night's Watch attachments that
yes,
do things.
Yeah.
Right, like back in the day, when Ranger Party saw a lot of play, you could put like a Long Claw on it, right, to give it renown and use it as a closer, right? If you needed like in some of those Ranger aggro decks that or Practice Blades, Dragonglass Daggers to sort of protect you from Targaryen Burn and turn off things like Small Theon or something, right? Protectors of the Realm is just like literally just a beat stick. It has no upside in that, except sometimes it just becomes gigantic, which is good. You know, don't get me wrong. Like when you do your counting turn, you know, it becomes a 5 for 10, right? Isn't 3, 4, 1 the exchange? That's like 7 reserve, 7 or 8, yeah. Yeah. So like,
8 reserve,
okay,
right?
Then it's just like a big beat stick, but it's not really doing a huge amount for you. It doesn't even have a trait, like as we'll get to with, like it has army, of course, but you know, it doesn't have the horn that wakes the sleepers kind of stuff. Like it's not like a ranger either. So like, there's literally the only upside about this card is that it could potentially have big strength. And of course, if it gets nightmares, it becomes 0. If it can be venomous bladed, like it just has. No, its floor is so low that I just don't ever see this making, unless Night's Watch truly, when rotation comes, the Night's Watch card pool becomes even more garbage than I expect it to become. I don't think that this will see much like competitive play. And then the Horn that Wakes the Sleepers, the current ruling is that you must have 3 separate characters with the trait, and it must be exactly 3. It can't be, oh, I have a builder and a ranger, or that. And while I think 1 is very low for this effect, I think, you know, design's been playing around with this whole like play all 3 traits theme in the last couple of like cycles. Last box, I think, had something like this. I think the Greyjoy box had a 1 cost location that has a similar, like, if you control all 3 traits, you can, I think, stand a bigger location or something like that. It's still, that wasn't very good, and this is still not really good. Just simply because you have to have all 3 traits for it to be valuable. And right now, there's nothing besides a couple of cards that's encouraging a Night's Watch deck to play the Tomas style. Tomas did really well in Valberg this past weekend from when this is being recorded. So like 2 or 3 weeks from this when this comes out. And he wasn't even playing traditional Tomas style mid-range Night's Watch. He was playing Jumbo. He was playing Jontron, whatever you want to call it, which, you know, might be able to get this if, you know, because sometimes it has like Halder. John has one of the traits, maybe thanks to the 0 drop location, and maybe you've got a Stuart from the reducer. And so maybe it could be a way to stand John and get a little extra value. But still, that deck has so many other cards and it has so many other medium or worse cards that it's playing. I just don't really see where this fits. Until a Tomas style deck comes back, which I don't think it's going to until rotation happens and builders becomes shitty or its power level gets significantly lower. And if you want to play defense strategy, there's like literally no reason not to be playing builders. Anyway, that's a long answer saying both of these cards are D's. This is a D faction.
I have a lot of Night's Watch opinion. We spent way more time on this Night's Watch than I was planning on, but I think you know, mostly summed up. I already talked a little about protectors and the horn that wakes the sleepers. My thought is basically there's just not really a Night's Watch deck that wants all 3 traits at the levels that card wants. So I'm gonna give these both D's or a D for the house.
Right? Absolutely. So that takes us over to Stark, which gives us a She-Bear, which is, again, non-loyal, three strength, three cost military icon, which seems to be a mini theme that's developing, or mini cycle that's of cards that's developing here. Reaction, it's a House Mormont, excuse me. Reaction, after you marshal She-Bear, you may put a Stark character attachment with printed cost three or lower into play from your hand. And that's supplemented by Bearskin Cloak, which is another House Mormont themed card. It's a one cost non-loyal attachment item. Attached character gets plus one strength. If attached character has the Mormont trait, it gains stealth. Let's just like dispose of Bearskin Cloak real quick. I think this card might see some play in a Kohor deck, maybe. But I don't think it would see any play outside of that. Okay. It's just like one of those like Kohor attachments. You know, if you want to be able to tutor it up because you need the stealth, or you want something that will let you fetch other better one cost attachments, you know, redundancy of the ability to search for things is valuable. I don't think there's enough good House Mormont characters that you would want to play it. Maybe, well, there's Alisane. I guess she's really busted. They're Umber, right? The draw guys are Umber, right? So really, Alisane is the only House Mormont that's seen a lot of play. Dacy is also a firmly playable card, so you know she's firmly medium.
Isn't the little two drop that searches out more Mormonts?
I love that card. Her get a decent, like, kind of fallen out a little bit. So it's like kind of you'll get stealth sometimes. So maybe if you build your Kohor deck that like high value Kohor, you'll definitely see play, but not very good. Firmly, I think, like a D card.
Yeah. I feel weird that I was defending this by mentioning that non-unique character, because I don't think that Bearskin Cloak,
is She-Bear, which I was very bullish on when we did the Second Sons episode that we talked about this. I'm more down on her. I think that Stark doesn't necessarily want this effect right now. A lot of that has to go with where Stark is right now. Where it would need this effect, it doesn't necessarily want it. Where I think you would see that, like, I think the best Stark deck you should be playing if you're playing right now, and he published it, is Wamas. You should just play Wamas UK Nationals deck if you want to play Stark, guys. Just play it. It's great. It didn't change very much. Maybe there's a couple cards you can shift around with the new cards that have come out. Deck's still good. It's probably the best deck in the meta. It's probably the tier one or S tier deck in the meta. She-Bear doesn't go in that deck. There might be some more lower to the ground Stark decks that sort of come to answer Wama style strategies, or to answer some of these like Bera decks that we're going to be getting, or to go under Greyjoy, or some kind of Stark crossing maybe that is like built slightly differently than the current Stark crossing lists that like really want to abuse crossing the Black Gate, because that's so like or a Stark Winter deck that's like aggro-y.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. That's what I've got my fingers crossed for. Stark's getting all this kind of alternative sort of income type stuff. Reduction put into play and card advantage things, that I've got my fingers crossed for Stark Winter to be viable.
Yeah, so I think she's a B-minus card. I think she's a little bit more narrow than she reads on the tin, but she's still a powerful effect, don't get me wrong, but I think Stark, it's like board flood isn't really where Stark is right now, but there could be Stark strategies, particularly that Stark Winter strategy, or some kind of low to the ground Stark crossing that wants her. So I would give Stark overall like a very high B minus, but that's simply because Bearskin Cloak is so garbage and She-Bear is a little bit more medium than I initially appreciated.
Yeah, I think something in the B range is very reasonable for these. I like seeing Mormont get more cards. They seem to be kind of the main traits that FFG's pushing in Stark right now. I feel like everything of interest we've gotten has all been Mormont for at least the last 6 months in Stark, so we'll kind of see how that goes, see if anything kind of comes together here. Chaining things up and just reflooding boards. I mean, I'm intrigued, and the bearskin cloak, I think, only has a home if that comes together, and even then I'm pretty skeptical that, man, that stealth, I still think stealth is pretty strong and not super common outside of maybe Greyjoy with the six drop Asha. So I want it to be worthwhile, but it's not. It's just not. So there we go.
Okay, you ready for some cards, reddish black cards?
Yeah. Yeah, red and black cards. sure, we've got the Targaryen cards next. First up is Hago, I guess. He is unique, non-loyal, 4-cost, military and power icons, 4-strength, Blood Rider and Dothraki, and reaction after you win a challenge in which Hago is participating. Discard a card from your hand to choose a Dothraki card in your discard pile and return it to your hand. And then we get a non-loyal attachment, Dothraki Steed, for 1. It's a warhorse. It says max 1 per character on it, but as we saw last week, that has been corrected to limit 1. And then says while attached character is attacking, it gets plus 1 strength, plus 3 instead, if it has the Dothraki trait. I'll start at the top with Dothraki Steed and say, of all the positive attachments, this one was the worst. And just mostly leave it there. Don't really know that we quite need this to enable anything, and it's pretty much just strictly objectively worse than equivalents in other houses. I'm looking at you, Greyjoy, with the Captain one. So, yeah. Less said about Dothraki Steed, the better, I think. Hago, on the other hand, I do find pretty interesting. We haven't gotten a ton to deal with Dothraki lately to really make that kind of gel. We've gotten bits and pieces and drips and drabs, so to speak, but it's never gelled into a deck type the way we had seen in prior editions. So I've kind of got my fingers crossed that we're about to approach a critical mass here, and that something that really follows that theme instead of either just a general target good stuff or a more specific burn theme are the only ways to go. So I don't know. I'm trying to think really what is your best game plan with this Hago, though. Let's see, because that Dothraki C, that just bounces them back to hand, right? After you put them in. Grabbing an army on the cheap with, say, Aegon sends them back to hand afterward as well. I don't know. Maybe if I've discarded some choice Dothraki to get Kotho into play and I need to get him back. I feel like I'm missing a connection here, Roy. Is there something really obvious I'm missing that he
I mean, says? I think Targaryen in general is all about just dumping cards, right, into its graveyard, into its discard pile. And there are a lot of effects in Dothraki itself that do this, right? You mentioned Quotho. There's the one, I think he was in the Greyjoy box, the one that has no icons, but you can discard a card. Koholo, right? That's really hungry.
But I'm just trading. Though, right? Well, like I have to discard a card to get a Dothraki.
But think about this. So, like you sometimes you're just gonna have to do this. Sometimes duplicates get, you know, like you had to save your Cal after a Valor turn. You play Hago. Okay. You discard a limited that you had in your hand, or an event, or a copy of a dead unique character from that Valor. Boom! You get your Drogo dupe. You dupe Drogo next turn.
That might be the one that sold it for me the most.
Like, I think it's just flexibility here. Like 4/4 is a fair rate, right? As a one of the extra trait, the ability to sort of just have that sort of card selection. So you get to trade the worst card in your hand for the best Dothraki card in your discard pile. And of course, there are Dothraki traded attachments, right? Are there?
I don't think so. I thought there were, but I just did a search for the Dothraki trait on ThronesDB, and I only got characters.
So if it's only characters, so that means you're trading the worst card in your hand for the best Dothraki card in your discard pile. I think that's pretty fair. I think he's not like, I mean, unless there's some sort of like broken combo that I'm not seeing, which there could always be. This is recursion. Well, it's not recursion, but it's some kind of messing around with your discard pile. That can be powerful, but just on a fair rate, this is a solid card. It's a like an X1 card in a Dothraki deck. Yeah. So I mean, it's a firmly like C+ B- card. I think Dothraki C is like, you know, the most Jim Henson card, I think, in the box. Like, it's the kind of card that reads to me is just bad. But again, it's a one drop attachment, which means there's always some Kohor abuse, like the ability to this has some marginal upside, gives +1 strength while attacking, +2 for Dothraki, which is pretty solid. You know, you can turn Hoggo into a 7 strength dude when he's attacking. But the ability to turn this into a milk or turn this into a seized or something like that, or into one of the combo attachments, I think a lot of them are one cost, is powerful. So I think it's like a C- D card because it's kind of like below replacement level on face, but I think it has some very narrow synergies in a kind of like Jim Henson style abuse the targ attachments kind of deck, maybe at a Kohor, maybe just playing a fair agenda. But I you know, it's just not a card you just immediately go, this makes me want to play Dothraki. And so I would give great targ C, mostly because I think that Dothraki C is so, you know, below replacement level, and Hoggo is replacement level, maybe a little bit above, kind of in that medium category. So yeah, it's like a C faction this time around. Nothing busted, but very solid with Hoggo.
That seems okay. I think I'm a little lower on it than that. I think I'm maybe in the C- range. Hoggo is doing a lot of work. I don't care for that Steve.
Okay, so that brings me to Tyrell, right?
Yes, sir.
All right, Hightower Knight, who I think is one of the more interesting cards we've talked about so far. He is a 4/4 military power, non-loyal House Hightower Knight action. Kneel a non-Tyrell Knight character to put Hightower Knight into play from your hand. And then Fields of the Reach is a one cost non-loyal reach location reaction. After you win a power challenge, kneel 3 reach locations to raise the claim value on your revealed plot card by 1 until end of the challenge. I don't know what to make of Fields of the Reach, and I think I said this on Second Sons. It's a weird card. Like, 1 gold for a possible claim raise is pretty powerful. Many Tyrell locations are marginally the reach. You know, I think the zero drop producer is not, right? It's been a while since I did a search for this trait.
I was going to say, I did a search. We get things like Bitterbridge Encampment, Caswell's Keep, High Garden, Hornhill, Jousting Pavilion is probably your main
Jousting
choice.
Pavilion's a good one because it has no reason to kneel otherwise, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the only other one that doesn't have a reason to kneel is Shield Islands, which I'm not seeing.
Yeah, there's really no chance of playing that. That's the permanent.
Yeah, it's Howling Mine. It's everybody.
Yeah, Howling Mine. Yeah, or permanent oh my god, what's the plot that the Wasa guys hate?
Time of Plenty, right?
Time of Plenty, yeah.
Yeah.
Time of Plenty, to be precise. But yes. Yeah, but you know, like, I mean, Hightower isn't, but both of both the Arbor and the Two Drop, right, are also both reach locations that don't have the meal?
No. The reach locations, let me scroll back through here, but I'm pretty sure the only ones, oh, no, Caswell's Keep does not meal. Sorry. You're right.
Caswell's Keep, but also, isn't Red Wine Straits the reach?
No.
It's not? And the Arbor and isn't either?
Unless the search is coming up wrong on Thrones.
Huh.
Redwyn Straits is, yeah, House Redwyn.
Huh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, well, so, I mean, definitely the zero drops, this makes this very much more appealing. So you'd be running this. The power claim one isn't the reach either? The rush one?
No.
Okay. Hmm. So it's really just the jousting pavilions
and so shield islands that don't kneel. I mean, maybe if you're not using a rose garden that turn.
So the zero drop location is a reach location.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. That actually. So that means your deck is running so 7 to 8 reach locations, 3 of which never have to kneel, and then in the middle to late game, you can sort of plan around not using those. Okay, that makes this more appealing to me. I don't think it's something you go all in on, because you definitely don't want to play like Craswell's Keep or something like that in your Knight's deck, or even
no, and maybe not even in your attempt at a control deck.
Right? Yeah. So like, and I think Fields of the Reach, because Jousting Pavilion is the card that just so easily synergizes with it, that you know you are going to want to play knights with this. So actually, I was going to say this is kind of like a C-minus card, but this actually becomes like a C+ B-minus card then. I think there's enough. It's the opportunity cost of playing this card isn't as bad as it might do on first on the tin. But I really want to talk about Hightower now, Knight, because I think this is the coolest deck building card. So I think that minimum every knight's deck is running what? At least the two drops from the, is he in the first cycle? Hedge Knights, right?
Yeah. And then, I think he was first cycle.
Then there's a couple of good knights in this neutral, just purely neutral knights in this, right? There's Lynn Corbe is in here, right? And he's pretty strong, and we'll get to him in a bit. And so that means there's like 4 minimum. And that's if you're running Tyrell. But if you bring this into a Banner Lion or you bring it into a Knight's Tyrell package, I think this becomes a really interesting card, particularly because it's just an action. It's not a challenges action.
Ooh.
So there's
can you
all
abuse
kinds
that
of
in other phase as much?
I think you could. I think there will be ways to do it. And
are we looking Mace, for a Mace Knight's deck?
I mean, yes. I mean, that was talked about in the Lancers chat. But like, you know, the opportunity cost in a Mace deck of running enough non-Tyrell Knights to make this valuable is not great. But I still think just the ability to like, what if you're worried about your opponent Ramseying you after marshaling, after they marched you. And your first action in the draw phase can be, or even the plot phase, you know, they, and is to go, okay, kneel my knight, put this into play. If you need that body, you know, because you're afraid of some kind of, BS that they're doing, and you want to make sure that you maintain your board presence, you could do it in some kind of, you know, To stop yourself from being marched. Your opponent sets up this kind of like marched situation where they're like, oh, I got you down to one character. And you go, no, kneel my Hedge Knight, put a Hightower Guard Knight into play in the taxation phase. You know, there's like, I think there's a lot of like, just kind of like good plays you can set up that sort of like outside of just simply ambushing this, a 4/4 Knight into play, that if you're running this kind of strategy with the other card, you know, you're all in on knights could just be really powerful. So I think that this is a solid, solid B card and makes me want to go and look at maybe a Bera. You know, there's some House Florent BS that could go around with the Bera cards here. And there's definitely some, you know, some Tyrell Lion stuff or Lannister Rose stuff that can like just really play around at knights. Like Hightower Knight really makes me want to mess around with the knight stuff again. And I haven't said that in a very long time. So exciting.
Well, you actually had way more to say about that particular assortment of Tyrell cards than I was even expecting. You know, the fields, as I kind of interjected there, is maybe interesting for somebody trying something very specific, but I don't think it's efficient enough to really make the cut in a general sense. The Hightower Knight, I just think is interesting. I mean, I guess I can get a little bit of action slash economy advantage here and there with some smaller characters like the Hedge Knight, as you said. But I don't know. I just don't know that I know the Tyrell deck that wants a totally vanilla knight character to do that with. If this knight character did anything, had a keyword of some kind, you know, something I could use.
He'd be busted if it had a keyword.
But alas, he doesn't. So I think Tyrell here is really looking at probably a C minus for me.
Cool.
Yep.
Well, here's a card. The next card does directly synergize with this knight, though. I was right about Lin. I remembered him well.
I guess, are we on to the neutrals already, then?
On to the neutral cards.
Is that is that me? Yeah, because you just read Tyrell. So Lin Corbray is a unique neutral character, 5 cost, military and intrigue icons, 4 strength, House Aaron and knight traits. He has stealth and reaction after an opponent initiates a power challenge against you. Stand Lin Corbray. I mean, he's just his ability and his icons just don't jive with each other right from the get-go, right? Like, there's a real issue here that you pretty much have to go have Lady Forlorn. Shout out to First Player Championship alt art promo. Thank you, Chris Thompson, for helping with those. Anyway, so it's I don't know. I look at him and I want to like this neutral stealth, but all these other neutral 5 costs, vaguely interesting characters we've looked at. I mean, what, the only one that's really seen any consistent play? Two maybe. Core Littlefinger and Sirio for the first year or so of the game. So I mean, I'm gonna be honest here, and I'm gonna say Lin's not gonna see play. He doesn't line up with you know, actually using his ability since he doesn't have the power icon natively. So I think Lin's probably a D in every practical sense of the term.
I don't think he's a D. I mean, he directly synergized with the card we just spoiled, right? I don't think you just throw Link. He's not. He's at most, going by the most like strict definition of our rating system, is at most a C. He's a niche card. He goes in knight's decks that want stealth, right? Like, knight's decks don't really have stealth unless they're running yellow cards, unless they're running bear cards, and they have like Davos. But they don't have a lot of stealth. They don't have, although it's getting a little bit better about this, they still don't have a huge number of intrigue icons, and they particularly don't have stealth on the intrigue icons, right?
I mean, that's true. That's...
So you want just like a one of him. You're not going to put 3, right? But if you're going first, this creates an interesting dilemma for decks, right? Where they you know, want to do the power challenge last, well, that means you're going to have someone standing for dominance. So then they're like, okay, well, then I will do my power challenge as my second challenge. Well, that means that you've got Lin to at least prevent unopposed. I don't think you're going to, you know, unless you give him a power icon somehow, going to be using his ability to, you know, make him participate in a power challenge. I think it just creates additional upside and creates like additional opportunities for synergy, additional opportunities for just a little bit of extra value that you're getting basically for paying 5 gold for a stealth. Which I think the nice decks want as a one of, not like 3x, oh my god, I want to, but combine it again, combine it with the next card that we're going to get to, combine it with this Tyrell Knight that we've saw, combine it with Box Garland. There's like, I think some kind of base green cards, Knights deck. I mean, we have that, right? With Barrow Rose Kohor, which, you know, is the closest thing we have a Knights deck right now. And that deck, you know, floats at high tier two, tier 1.5, sometimes swinging into tier one for a while, for close to a year now, since Hanno first innovated it. And I think that that shows that there is enough Knights synergy to be competitive right now. And we're just getting a bunch of Knights synergy cards dumped on us. And so I think that this is definitely an archetype you want to revisit with some kind of ways in which I think the core of the deck is green cards, Tyrell cards. So I would give him like a CC plus, just simply because I think he opens up space in Knights.
Wow. You're way, way warmer on Lin than me. I'm desperately curious what you think of the next card then.
Oh, which I will read. Unlikely Champion. 3 for 2 Knight character, neutral, of course. Military and intrigue. Again, 2 strength. While you control a lord or lady character, unlikely champion gains a power icon. This is one of the most busted neutral chuds they printed in a good long while, right? Like, how? Like, most factions can have a lord or lady, right? I mean, except Night's Watch, which is definitely not running this card, but it already has a busted, even cheaper, easy to turn on tricon.
Is a vanilla, like, 3-2 Tricon busted, though?
Yeah, I mean, I think that just the flexibility, running 3 of these in your deck, so that means that you have the synergy that you want with a knight in every single challenge now. And there's so many knight's tricks, right? Like, I think it just turns on your synergy. So it means that you can have, for every challenge, you can either defend it or you can oppose it. You can defend or attack on all three challenges. It just solves any icon hole. It smooths out your draw. Plenty of the good knights are also lords. And particularly the really powerful ones out of Tyrell or Baratheon. Or Lannister. Right? Because Jaime is both a lord and a knight, right? And I think you're gonna play 3x of this in most Knights decks. I think it just creates additional consistency and gives you that trait. Like, imagine, you know, you're at your knight opponent is at like 11 power and they fire off like an intrigue challenge with unlikely champion. And you know they can throw a big military or a big power challenge and you don't have a huge number of defenders. Well, you're going to be scared right now of that intrigue challenge, which they may not have been able to do, this chump intrigue challenge, that they can Lady Stance's Rose and make it so it makes it easier for them to close on the other challenges. Gives them more flexibility, right? Because they now have an additional challenge that they can just get with a solid chud that at the end of the day, you kill this chud, you get one decent challenge through or one good block with this dude and he dies? Okay. You paid 3 gold for a tricon.
I mean, man, one good challenge or one good block with a dude, like a vanilla dude, like, I'm just kind of shocked here that this is kind of where we've come, that like that is
crazy. Because you have so many haymakers. You have so many haymakers. That deck never lacked for haymakers, right, Will?
I mean,
That's never been the knight's problem, right? There's been plenty of payoff, but no glue to hold the deck together.
Having the icon diversity is nice, and you know I would never be one to naysay that in regards to crossing for sure. But I just really think the card pools of most houses are rich enough now that they can fill that icon hole one way or another. Even specifically in a knight deck. I mean, you're almost certainly, as you said, doing that with a Tyrell or Rose presence. And honestly, they have a really good icon spread, like in-house natively.
But do they have it at 3 gold?
I mean, they've got, was it Knight of the Reach off the top of my head? Not a Tricon, but they have the Injured Icon, which is...
Right, but that's 5 gold, isn't it, if I remember correctly?
Sorry, am I mixing that up with the discard one? I mean the one that gives a Lord or a Lady a power after it wins. Yeah, Knight of the Reach is the one I meant.
Knight of the Reach, yeah, okay, cool.
That's three. So that's
Knight of the Reach. Yeah, they're also interchangeably named. Yeah. Okay, this is a good card. Yeah?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's just what pops into my head right off the top.
You get one power if you win if you win while it's defending alone. You get one more strength, but you lose the icon.
You do lose that icon.
So I think that's a fair trade.
The ability for and lack of strength for the icon. And neutral, so you can't use in-house effects that, say, need a Tyrell character or whatever. Even just a Rose Road for reduction.
Right. But again, you've got 3 icons with this young boy right here. And I think that that's a big upside. I think you run both in your Tyrell deck that's wanting to do this. It's just like, I think that maybe I'm overvaluing all 3 icons. But I think that, you know, having played enough builders, having a easy to turn on Tricon that doesn't do anything else but turn on your synergies and allow you to attack or defend all 3 challenges is, I think that this pushes knights towards a kind of, I don't want to say builders in the sense that has the same strategy, but knights is at a similar place to builders when it comes to knight to the synergy. Level of knights, where there's just enough of them across the that are medium or better across the cost slot that you can build a consistent, powerful deck that the synergies that you want are always on. And that's the thing I think that knights has traditionally suffered from. And going all the way back to the core set and then the first cycle knights deck that I did pretty well with for a little while, and then even this Barrow Rose deck, like it is quite capable to turn off its synergies if it draws awkwardly. Well, now you have no awkward draws because you can basically run an entire character package that's either busted Tyrell or whatever your banner faction is, busted lords or ladies, and then the rest are knights.
Oh, maybe. I mean, this is another one where I feel like we are like getting out in the weeds, like arguing over nitty gritty of something that I think we're probably both going to be rating, what, a C? A flat C?
I'm going to be more aggressive. I think being more aggressive here is like, I'm going to give this like a B minus. Like, I think that this is really powerful. And it, again, makes me want to just like play a bunch of dumb dorks and play the Knights, the Knights power claim shit. And I think that's a deck right there that can keep up with the meta. May not be like literally the best thing that you could be doing, but it's a solid competitive option.
Whew. All right, well, I guess we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah. To you, tell us all about Engai.
All right. Engai the Archer is our next neutral. He's unique. 2 cost, military and power icons, 2 strength, brotherhood, R'hllor. While you control no loyal characters, Engai the Archer does not deal when declared as an attacker or defender in a military challenge. This one I actually am much more high on than our knight just a moment ago. I think Engai is a very efficient character, especially compared to what we get at the low end of the cost curve in Game of Thrones 2nd Edition, and especially what we get in neutral at the low end of the cost curve. There's a lot. I mean, even aside from the fact that I hope that maybe he can make the Brotherhood agenda deck kind of click when you have a non-kneeler that has insight or, you know, whatever keyword you've awarded via the agenda. Stealth. There we go. But even outside of that in particular, there's other decks where I run a surprisingly small number of loyal characters. Martell comes to mind, where I think the last build I was running, the only one was maybe Obara, if I remember right off the top of my head.
On the character level, I think you can run a competitive Martell deck that has no loyal characters. And do it with the only opportunity cost you really give up is Greenblood Trader.
I probably did have traders in that deck as well. I did forget about that.
Because think about it, the Shadow City Bastard, Dornish Spy, the girl that brings things in and out of shadows, they're all non-loyal. Arion is non-loyal. And we'll get to why this is important in the next card as well. I think it's quite possible. I think this is a 1x in a Knight's Watch, not Knight's Watch, excuse me, in a Martell deck that kind of wants to play for the board. I think you definitely will see one of Engai in there.
Yeah, so. I think he looks really cool. I think there's, I'm having a little bit of a harder time. I feel like a lot of other houses have some of their real key cards. Loyal, now that I'm really stopping to think. But I think he seems very reasonable. I think Engai probably gets a B to B plus from me.
Yeah, he's a B to me. I mean, you're going to hate him playing against Free Folk. He's kind of a build your own Alisane in Brotherhood decks. He's just efficient, powerful. If Free Folk got two really powerful cards in this pack, which I'm sure people really hate because it's probably the most behated agenda out there. Definitely a solid B card. He does what he says on the tin is powerful. And if your deck doesn't care about the loyal part, then why would you not include him?
I've got nothing. I have no reason.
And the next card gives you a reason to not want to be playing a lot or any loyal characters in your deck, and that is the Hollow Hill, which is a unique Brotherhood Westeros 2-cost location dominance action. If you control no loyal characters, kneel Hollow Hill to search the top 10 cards of your deck for a non-loyal character, reveal it, and add it to your hand, shuffle your deck. Glazer, in the brief second he was able to be, that this fixes the draw of every faction if they really want to, which is true. But I want to start from the easiest place and where my hobby horse is and just sort of work backwards. So Free Folk, I think Free Folk has a point. Like I said this on Suns, Free Folk's one of its biggest problem in many ways was that it had no refill. So if you were able to stall them out or valor them away or force them to play to the board, then valor them, they had no way of refilling and you'd win. Hollow Hill gives them the ability to refill at no opportunity cost. You play a 2-cost location, you make it to the dominance phase, you get a character. Very, very strong. And I think it creates more consistency for Free Folk. As similar truth is to the Brotherhood decks. Brotherhood decks can't run loyal characters, so you never miss when it comes to characters. Obviously, if your locations make up the top 10 cards of your deck, you're out of luck. But, the way most decks are built, it's very difficult to not run into at least one character. So that you've got two decks, that this is just 100% upside. That brings us to factions like Martell. I think Martell 100% runs this. And I think that, you know, particularly with things like the ability to move your draw into schemes or your plot deck in Martell, and so not running the traders. So basically, again, as we said earlier with Engai, there's no reason to not run Hollow Hill. Because again, you're making up for losing Greenblood Traders by playing Hollow Hill, which means you are every turn in the dominance phase searching your deck for characters and getting them. So you're refilling every turn in the dominance phase. And then, of course, that question can be asked of other factions, which maybe Lannister, this is, I think, something Glazer's been exploring, could do this. Like, you know, you cut your Tywin boys, but you go for some clansman style strategy that most of the characters are non-loyal. Maybe that might be stretching it. Or some strong banner package, some false banner deck that is running, you know, maybe a couple of loyal characters, the Tywins of the world, the one of the Roberts or something, but everything else is of your banner faction. Well, all those banner cards are non-loyal if they're characters. And then there's some cool things, like if you are running a Varys deck, the ability to have half of your combo of Last of the Giants in your hand and then tutor up Varys, extremely strong. I think that this is probably the best non-yellow card in the deck, in the box. This is a borderline S tier card.
Ooh, that's pretty bold. I like it a lot. I wasn't sure if I was going to go quite S tier, but I was thinking a pretty reasonable A. I mean, waiting till dominance is really probably the biggest thing that kind of dings me. I mean, we've seen as draw or card advantage effects, like the later they move into a turn, the weaker they are and the harder it is to take advantage of them. So that, you know, when we saw the switch to second edition and so much of the draw was in challenges rather than marshalling, that made a real difference. And now that we've got a few things active in marshalling, I think people can tell a real difference in their game when they're able to take advantage of that. The Umber, what, Berserkers or whatever they are, or something along those lines. Loyalists, there we go. To draw in marshalling. And so something like this that pushes even further back into dominance does worry me a little bit about that application. I mean, yes, you can do something like search up one half of the Varys Last of the Giants, as you said. But that's one of the very few things that you can search up and take advantage of right then. Everything else you've got to search. I mean, I guess you come up after intrigue, so that's good, but before reserve, and you have such a narrow window to play anything. Ah, man. And maybe you come back around on plots. For some reason down here, Heads on Spikes is super popular again.
So let's compare this to some cards that have a similar effect. Eastwatch. So Eastwatch's requirement is that you have higher reserve than your opponent, right? And then in dominance phase, you draw a card. Is that a bad card, Will?
I mean,
it's seen a play. It currently is not. It comes in and out of builders, depending on like what your flex spots
yes.
are.
I mean, and the thing is,
a lot of play.
It doesn't require any other deck building considerations or tweaking of, you know, what you choose for military claims, say, meaning, you know, maybe you are playing the bare minimum of loyals in our Martell example, and you kill the traitor, so you don't have a loyal anymore. Eastwatch, you don't have to play any tricks like that. It's just after dominance begins. So I would say it's easier on the triggering front.
But sometimes you have no control over what your opponent's reserve, what your opponent's reserve is going to be, right? So even with that plus one reserve that's printed on Eastwatch, you know, sometimes you'll play For the Watch, which becomes a 7 initiative plot or 7 reserve plot. Your opponent just countings that turn, and it's turned off, right? But then let's go to a even better, I think, card, which is Red Keep. For all intents and purposes, Red Keep is a dominance. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You don't get to use the cards in challenges. So is that a bad card?
I would say no, but it also helps with challenges, like winning challenges. It helps activate itself. And actually, so does Eastwatch, as you said, with the reserve bonus. Hollow Hill does not help activate itself.
Absolutely correct. But Hollow Hill is a neutral card. So immediately that is a cost to the design space of the card, right? Because any faction can run it without any opportunity cost besides putting the card in their deck. You just literally are like, I want to put this card in my deck. So that means there has to be some kind of drawback or some kind of limitation, some kind of niche. It costs less than a card like the Red Keep. So, okay, 2 gold for a neutral location is very reasonable and willing to people. We've played other slower, grindier neutral locations like the Iron Throne that are powerful, but, you know, don't always have an upside and sometimes they're just dead draws. And then what's so different than those other two cards, though, is you get to pick the card. Now, you can whiff. You always draw a card if you get to trigger Eastwatch. You always draw a card when you get to trigger Red Keep, draw 2 cards in the case of Red Keep. But here you get to pick. So you always know, and you get to pick at the point in which you are ready to start planning your next round.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
In the dominance phase. Like, you know what the board is going to be. You know, generally speaking, like, at least going into marshalling, like, you know, you have about as much information, maybe. Well, you don't know what your opponent's plot is going to be. So you have about half the information, for being ungenerous, to what you would go into with the top 2 cards of your deck. So now you get to look at the top 10 cards of your deck, pick the best non-loyal character, and the requirement is that you don't run any loyal characters in your deck, or close to none, because if you 50-50 slot.
Well, you don't have. And I do love that you can grab any non-loyal character, and the fact that it can be an in-house non-loyal character. I mean, that is pretty huge, I do admit. Like, that's a very
wide. Being able to fetch up, like, Hightower Spy. Like, that's even, like, not even going for, like, some of the busted ones, like Dornish Spy, right? Or Red Priest, right? To be able to go, like, boom, look at my deck. Oh, Red Priest, pull that out. I'm going to be able to take the best card of your hand in marshalling. Is super strong. Like, I think this is the most, I mean, we haven't had, as far as I know, any neutral draw, right, in the game? Oh, I guess the 2-drop dude that you either give him a power or draw a card. Poor Fellows.
Yeah, Poor Fellows. And King's Landing.
King's Landing, that's true.
It's not really draw.
Yeah, and but that's ends up being effect, like an overpriced maybe. Thing, but it's still a powerful effect. Like, if you get a King's Landing to stick, like, it's powerful. Yeah. But it's proven to be relatively balanced. And this is the most, at the very least, the most aggressively pushed neutral draw in second edition. And
I think that if your faction can
afford that opportunity cost of not running any loyal characters. Now, the easiest one's Martell, but I bet if you're creative, there are other factions you can do it in. This is such a strong effect. Yes, it's not in challenges. Yes, it's not in marshalling. But every turn. Every turn you get to trigger this. And I think that's super valuable particularly if you can extend the game. And that's why this is so good in Martell, right? Because so many of those loyal Martell characters are all about extending the game. The non-loyal ones, excuse me.
Yes, or the non-loyal ones.
Anyway, yeah. Yes. Yeah. So anyway, that's the end of my soapbox. No, that's why I think this is A+ S tier card.
I came off as sounding more down in opposition to Roy here. I mean, I'm not going S, but I do still think it's probably in the A range. I think this can have some very nice application. And between this and Angai, I really do hope that a Brotherhood deck finally comes together in a truly viable form.
Okay, up next, I think that's back over to me for Lady Forlorn.
Fortuitous here, since this was the Valerian Steel promo we had for the Midwest Circuit over at First Player, so that's pretty sweet. We've got Lady Forlorn, a unique neutral attachment, 2 cost, Valerian Steel and weapon, and the attached character gets +1 strength for each neutral location you control. If attached character is Lynn Corbray, he gains a power icon.
This card's just bad.
Yeah. my opinion on Lady Forlorn is very similar to my opinion on Lynn Corbray, only worse.
Oh, I mean, it's just like it's a thematic attachment. I think it's a cool like shaga casual kind of fun deck card. I don't even think it really has a reason to be played in like a cohort deck. They're just better two cost attachments in just about every faction that you would want. So like, there's just no reason to play it unless you just really want to have fun with the cards.
And like, it's not a competitive even card. Fun. It's just like it's a strength boost, and that's
basically
if we want to get it's a strength boost and giving Lin the icon he needs for his ability to actually matter.
When I first started playing First Edition, I would have gotten a thrill out of putting Lady Florhorn on Lin Corbray. Like, there's that basic, like, netty theme gasm that you can get with these kind of cards. It's cool, but there's nothing here but that.
So, and this is one of my favorite, like, flavor, like, quaternary characters. Can I... Has that term been used? I feel like he's
tertiary. I mean, he's big enough of a deal that he's tertiary, right? Because he's clearly going to be important to Sansa's like plot. Like he gets enough like details, you know, that he's a pederast and that he's important in the Vale politics. That he's clearly going to play some kind of like secondary or tertiary role in Sansa's plot. So yeah, he's like a tertiary character.
Okay, that's fair. And there's a lot of flavor dripping from the Lady Forlorn name and all, so I just wish it was exciting enough to play, as is. Dare I go to F? I think I'm going to go to F.
It's an F. It's an F card. Like, it's a theme win in some ways, in the sense that, like, it synergizes with Lin, and it's named after, it's his sword.
I mean, that's all the flavor. The ability is like, not very viable.
Okay. No, but I mean, to be fair, it's not like Lin Corbray like being angry and manipulated by Littlefinger. Like, that's hard to... I mean, this kind of conveys that.
If it was aggressive card, I might even...
So,
this was like a zero drop? He's I'd good look at that and say, you know, maybe.
Oh, yeah. But it would be busted. Like, the design space for these, like, thematic, possibly neutral weapon attachments is just, like... It's not safe design space.
Speaking of not safe design space,
it's gonna get
why don't you kick us over to the next card? Oh, whoops. I skipped a
Defiance.
Card accidentally. Okay, yes. You are correct.
Which is a zero cost.
I was busy looking at the next one.
Oh. Okay. Okay, cool. Defiance, which is a zero cost... not attachment, zero cost event, excuse me. And it is a challenges action. Choose and send a character that has not participated in a challenge this phase. Max one per phase. This card is cool. Like, this is probably up there with, what was it? The Martell Chud, Prince's attendant that we talked about earlier. That's up there with this, like, it's kind of a more powerful effect than you might expect. And it's clearly, like, you know, how they've said that they try to put these, like, answers to the themes of the main faction in the box cards, and they haven't really worked out. I don't think Defiance is like almost there. And
almost,
I mean,
the best use is probably some sort of character with a strong marshalling effect that is also a strong body in challenges, right? So, like, kind of come up. Well, it could be a challenges effect as well, right? I suppose this could be a gray wind that you could eat something with and stand and attack.
Yeah. I think this card would see some play if Rookery took over as a format, because it's like if you're playing like a Voltron or a combo strategy and you run into a Neil deck, this is powerful, right? You know, they Neil your dude, you get Defiance. As an extra, you know, silver bullet for those sort of situations. But other than that, like, I just don't see, and, you know, maybe in, if Darkwing's Dark Words was ever to return, this might see play, but I still think its application is too narrow to be anything higher than a D for me. Unless, you know, the combo players of the world find some busted, like, way to abuse this card. You know, like, there's something that kneels in the challenges phase for a non-challenge-based action that you want to, like, abuse. You know, like, if there was an Illyn Payne that only went off in challenges.
Sure.
You could do this, but I don't see it running, being run. So it's like a D card.
I don't think the targets are there. Is it possible something will be printed later? Yes. And I think that is the only case it really becomes useful. Just as kind of the meta answer to Barrett Neil, I don't really think Defiance will be there. I mean, Neil arguably was way more oppressive at different points in first edition's history than it ever has been in second edition. And wasn't there a very similar event that stood a character and then drew you a card in first edition and that didn't see play?
I thought that saw play occasionally.
Maybe it
didn't it?
I don't really remember it.
Like in rush decks, didn't it, like, wasn't there a, like, I mean, this is super not good radio, so we should probably get off it pretty quick.
Sure.
But wasn't there, like, it stood characters based on their trait, and then you drew a card? So if they had one of the not the traits, the one of the symbols or whatever they were called, occasionally saw play?
Yeah, that one did see play. That didn't even draw a card. It just stood somewhere.
Like rush decks,
with
right?
A certain crest. Yeah, yeah. But I think there was one that specifically answered Neil the way this one did, that did not see play. Because the one you're thinking of, Distinct Mastery, I think it was, you could attack with a character, then stand it, then attack again.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So, I don't know. That's down a first ed rabbit hole that I'm sure most of our listeners these days are really tired of. But it amounts to me thinking Defiance is probably an F as well.
I think it's a D. I think it has enough niche uses, and it's possibly abusable that I'm going to hedge my bets and make it a D.
Sure.
All right. But you get to read the Broken Design Space card.
Yeah.
So
this is the one I was thinking of. So this is the prince that was promised. It's our agenda for the box. It's a prophecy. And after all agendas are announced, name a unique character. Other characters you control cannot gain power. And reaction, after you win a power challenge by 5 or more strength, kneel your faction card to either stand the named character and draw a card, or search your deck, discard pile, and dead pile for the named character, reveal it, add it to your hand, and shuffle your deck. So that's pretty cool. There is a rules issue with this that I had not thought of beforehand, that I just thought of now. Was this addressed in the FAQ article that Michael put up, or am I discovering or thinking of this first? Should have thought of this before I started reading.
Well, why don't you say what it is, Will, and I can try to help you.
Here we go. This doesn't actually say it either, because I got the FAQ open. So anyway, here's what I'm looking at that just now hit me. So it says, search your deck, discard pile, and dead pile for the named character. Reveal it, add it to your hand, and shuffle your deck. It doesn't say for a copy of, and it does list multiple locations. Can I pull all copies of that character, and or could I, if not that, can I find a copy in the deck and a copy in the discard pile or whatever combination it may
be? I believe it is a single copy.
That makes sense. That's what I had completely assumed until reading the card out loud this way.
I mean, the templating on this agenda is like just across the board. Like, you know, it doesn't do the time saving thing of, you know, like you'll in other card games when you see this effect, you know, search your deck, discard pile or dead pile for the named character, and if you searched your deck, shuffle it, you know, so that you save a step. Like under the rules, and if you're judging, you have to make the player shuffle their deck. So even if they pull it out of the dead pile, which is super stupid and is a giant waste of time. For everybody involved. because just the templating is really poor. The other rules sort of thing that you need to know about this card is it's currently being ruled that operates like Wyman. So even if you don't control the character or the character isn't participating in the challenge or anything like that, you can still draw a card. So if you win a power challenge by five or more, you can just draw a card.
That is awkward and unexpected.
That's what Glazer hinted at earlier again about neutral draw. That this is sort of a power challenge-based draw agenda. I think I'm on the record probably since, I mean, when I came on the show and Reigns was king, I really just despise the design space of all three of these agendas. And I think the way they push the game is pretty both a playstyle I don't like, but I also think it's generally unhealthy because it just promotes a purely efficient good stuff deck. And I think that this one is going to end up being just as annoying as Reigns and Sea of Blood. Perhaps not as immediately oppressive as Sea of Blood became, but is going to be as omnipresent as Reigns was in its day before it got power creeped out by other agendas.
That's a big thing that annoys me about the cycle. They've been stretched so far out that the three challenge agendas are not roughly co-equal.
But with the context of the card pool in which when they released, they're co-equal, I think. You know, Reigns suffered from being the first pushed agenda that they printed, besides Lord of the Crossing. So, you know, being so early, its power level is going to always be kind of lower than they sort of like realize that for agendas to see play, they really have to be pushed. You know, and that's a whole broader episode that we could do about that problem, I think, in second edition. But just the ability to always draw a card when you win a power challenge by five is really strong. And then, of course, you know, having access to the best character in your faction, you know, is really strong. You know, I think you're going to see Greyjoy Prince decks. I think you're going to see Stark Prince decks. I think you're going to definitely, and Stark Prince decks that are both, on one hand, Fat Cat style combo decks that want easy access to Catelyn, and then the ability to just never, like, you can never run the deck out of, like, the deck just will win eventually. Like, you, the previous counterplay that you had against it, which you could sort of, like, trap a cat and kill her, just doesn't work anymore. But also just like naming Rob as this as your prince kind of Stark decks or Wyman, just the ability to stand a character, draw a card, or just draw a card is really, really strong.
Maybe you draw multiple cards at that point.
Yeah,
Wyman and the agenda itself as well. I mean,
yeah, it's just a very powerful agenda that, and, you know, Renly. You know, I think maybe it's weakened Tyrell because Tyrell has so much native renown. There is a legitimate opportunity cost.
Yeah.
But Martell, like you will definitely see Prince decks throughout all eight factions. Probably Tyrell will end up being the weakest, but I still think the deck is firmly like above medium.
Ooh, all eight? So. I actually don't know. I really think that there's some houses that are a lot much more noticeably weak to that power challenge than others. And that's not even considering the renown issue that you pointed out with Tyrell. But I do think, you know, winning that power by five is going to be a little bit trickier for Martell and Lannister. Particularly because some of the like key characters that I would want to maybe grab with Lannister either, you know, would be the person I would already need to be winning that by five or don't have it themselves. So they're a hole.
A Cersei, a big Cersei that can never die, is pretty strong.
I mean, if I can win the power by five, what? I guess I'm rounding out with Tywin and the Hound.
Tyrion.
And Tyrion, yeah.
And the Hound. And I'm sure, like, if we dug into the some of the clansmen have power icons. I'm sure if we dug in, we could find enough power icons to make the deck work, right? I don't think Lannister's problem in the power in the blue icons is as bad as it was back in the day. I think if you build your, I mean, we said this about Sea of Blood, right? that some factions won't be able to abuse it. And then that's true in the sense that you didn't see Sea of Blood decks at the top of the meta for every faction, but that doesn't mean, like, I think that every faction had a playable, competitive Sea of Blood deck. The problem was Sea of Blood was so good that the Stark, the Greyjoy, and to a lesser extent the Targaryen, just like pushed everything else out. Like, there was no reason to if you wanted to play Sea of Blood, you just picked one of those two factions.
Can I
think that same case is going to be with Prince.
Can I pause? Then this is probably a different, borderline existential question that's going to derail the episode. But I'm very curious because your paragraph there just went from a competitive build was available in all eight factions to immediately saying that these three factions, Greyjoy, Stark, and to a lesser extent Greyjoy, pushed all of the others out. So I'm exceedingly curious what your definition of competitive is for that criteria to fit.
Okay, good.
Because the latter statement really sounds like it negates the
prior. How about this? Competitive, what I mean is it has consistency, a game plan, and it is a well-constructed deck.
That sounds like playable. I think that's a wildly different definition.
One of the things I think is how I put this.
Or many of our listeners use.
How may I put this? A competitively built deck might be the more precise term. I think a lot of people don't actually build decks with competition in mind, even if they take them to tournaments. I think that's a problem that we have sometimes in the community, that you run into people sort of like playing decks that, you know, might work in a sense, but don't have a clear game plan and don't have, you know, synergies and efficiency and consistency within itself. And I think that, you know, you can have a competitively built deck. You know, there's the cards for a competitively built deck in, say, Sea of Blood, in Night's Watch, in Tyrell, in Martell, in, you know, well, obviously Greyjoy, obviously Stark. People were playing around with Baratheon. Like, those decks were, they were decks. They were good decks in the sense that, like, they had a game plan. They had 60, 61 cards that made sense to be in the deck that were efficient and furthered that deck's game plan.
I feel like we need a different terminology here. Possibly
fair, like
coherently built, functionally built,
fair.
Something along those lines.
Fair. I think, Will, how may I put this? You know, I'm normally known for being very generous, but I actually, when it comes to the quality of decks that are sometimes built, I'm very ungenerous. I have a weirdly low and high bar. I think that that just not enough decks in this game are built well, I guess would be the way to put it. And I think that that's a bar that a lot of decks, even decks that sometimes do okay or well in a tournament, you know, just they're not there to me. They're not what I would say competitively built or competitive.
So
now where you strike these, like where I see the tier system for me to break the tier list in is once you reach that competitive level to how I see it, and I've listed some of the things I look at, then I start ranking them by tiers. So a deck can be tier 3 and I would never take it to a tournament, but it's a competitively built good deck. Like, it's a good deck in the sense that it does what it's supposed to do. It has a game plan. It can win games. It is, you know, thinking about, you know, winning tournament games consistently. But it doesn't mean it's a good choice for a weekend. Then we start getting into tier 2, tier 1.5, tier 1 decks. That these are the decks that you really want to be playing. And
the ones that stand a reasonable chance in a competition.
In a competition, in a tournament, that will win a weekend consistently.
Sure.
So that's how I would do it. And that's a whole side episode. So you may end up trimming this.
That is a different episode. And now I want to follow up and ask, are there decks that, and this is where I feel the terminology you use makes discussion difficult to track, which is why I want them separated. Because now I want to ask, are there decks that are competitive, i.e. tier 1 and 1.5, and can win a competition that are not competitively built, i.e. have some suboptimal construction, like
Yes.
This gets confusing to talk about.
Yeah. The Tyrell Summer that came in second place at Stalag this past year. I think that that deck is a pile of hard garbage. So I think that that deck did really well at a tournament. It obviously was played by a skilled player, but I think that that deck is a firmly medium pile of green cards that win condition is the clock. And maybe that's its own like competitive thing, but and I've been so consistently unimpressed by that deck since that weekend that that's to me the go-to example. So
okay. Well, like I said, I knew when I brought it up that I was going to derail that discussion. I'm anyway. Sure there's more to be had, but for the moment, I'll just table it by saying, listeners, I desperately want you to respond in the comments and help us dream up new terminology so that we can force Roy to change.
Which is fine.
I will adopt, popular choices here. I just want the terminology more firmly delineated for discussion purposes.
Which is fair, Will. I was being I'm sloppy, but I have very strong opinions about deck and the ways in which deck construction works. And if you want to listen to those opinions and how I think they shape you should form the meta, you can listen to my How and Why of It videos, which
they're good.
Which lay out sort of my opinions about decks and how they work and how they should be constructed. So,
yeah. Anyway, it's quality stuff.
The print that was promised is very strong, and I would not be surprised to see it played in all eight agendas or eight factions. I think that there again are factions that will end up pushing the others out. Like if you go into a weekend saying I want to play the prince that was promised, you might be like, "Ooh, I want to play Martell Prince because I want to do the Red Viper or something." And that can be, you can build a solid deck out of it if we want to be generous as possible. But it's just not, it's just, you'd be better off playing, say, Greyjoy or or Stark.
Yeah, I was going to say, the three that probably stand the best chance of edging everyone else out with this agenda is probably Greyjoy, Stark, Baratheon, right? With a possible chance at Targ.
Yeah, like Targ doesn't have a lot of native renown. So, you know, that's Targ's always been Targ's problem. So like, you know, Prince Khal Drogo or a Prince Dany is strong. Like it's definitely worth exploring.
It is amusing that you can play a Prince Dany.
Well, you know, Prince in Valyrian is a gender neutral term, so.
Right. Which is why it's amusing to me. Like they didn't force it to be a lord character. I like that it keeps that ambiguity.
Well, I won't.
To be fair, it could also be the dragon that was promised, but that's neither here nor there.
I will not provide any spoilers about how much the prince that was promised matters or does not matter to the end game of the Song of Fire. But I think this agenda is S tier.
Too soon, Roy.
I think this agenda is definitely S tier. And expect to see it. I think expect to see it a lot in the sort of what I think Dance with Dragons might be the first like 20 plus person tournament with the box legal, which will be kind of our week one meta. I would expect like the first couple of weeks of the meta to be just full of Prince decks. And obviously the, you know, that becomes the Darwinian struggle of all decks. And we'll see a handful rise to sort of being consistent presence in the meta. But I would definitely expect for the first couple of weeks of this box meta that people will be playing a lot of Prince decks. From what I understand, Iron Throne is currently full of them. And you just be prepared for this you know, just pure efficiency of this agenda.
Yeah, I think it's going to be quite strong. Part of me wants to put it on the watch list of melee items, along with several other cards in this box. But I do think the lack of renown on other characters may rein it into the right spot. I hope.
Yeah. I think that factor will keep it under control in melee, because melee is just, again, so degenerate that I really don't see the inability to to have renown on other bodies to be worth it. Because so much incidental renown is important in melee, unless you're going into some kind of like combo strategy, that shutting that down is just, I think, just lowering the explosive power of your deck.
Yeah, I think that there's a very good chance you're gonna have to be all in on all your eggs in one basket, to mix up some metaphors here. And as rare as an answer is played in melee, that would be the one time someone will actually be playing a Milk of the Poppy or something, whatever it might be. All righty. On to our next one. That's back to you.
All right. Give me 1 second. That brings us, I believe, to Outwit. Hello, old friend. It is a plot. We're on the plots now. 3015 plot deck women one scheme plot that says interrupt when the effects of a revealed ability would initiate, kneel your faction card and a unique Maester character to cancel those effects. So Outwit is really, really powerful. It was 2 Maesters in first edition,
that
right?
Sounds right.
Unique Maester. So this is a big boost to Conclave.
Oh no, just coming it, was, so it was Neil busted. One learned character.
Right.
Yeah.
One learned character. Yeah. Right? So it was even harder in many cases, because not all Maesters were learned characters. So it's a busted effect, right? We can agree, you and me, Will, that like canceling your opponent's plot has been shown to be a busted effect. We remember the tyranny of the Martell Wars decks that were running the plot canceled it for a good while. But the opportunity cost of having it to be a unique maester, is relatively high, because some factions' maesters are just pure garbage. You don't want to be running them. I can think of, one faction doesn't have a single, in faction unique maester, which is Targaryen. So Targaryen has to put bad cards in their deck to run it. So you probably won't see
any.
I don't believe they do. I don't believe they do. So you have to be putting bad cards in your deck, because most of the neutral maester. Martell might have it has one coming up, right? It has that 4-drop one,
right?
That's coming in the cycle. That let's take a look at the top card. But yeah, it currently just has Lomis. It has also has the guy who shuffles in shuffles in events.
Bard. He is
Lazy Leo.
Indeed, a maester.
I thought he was a maester. He's okay, but that's still like there's so many better green cards that you want to be running. Probably the only factions that just have straight up like good maesters that you want to be running anyway, or could argue for running anyway, is Greyjoy, Stark,
Hooray,
and more plot canceled for Martell and Brown. Those 4, actually. I just remembered. But I don't think Martell, Maester Kendry is fine, but he's not that great. That brings you to this is a Conclave boost. I actually think that this is like legitimately the card Conclave has really wanted, because it gives you a reason to be playing Conclave, like something that your deck can do consistently that almost every other agenda in the game can't out of any faction, which is cancel plots.
But how many plots do you want to cancel? Because this is a guessing game, right? You have to... go ahead and use up your plot reveal on the turn, which is a pretty big action, cost trade-off here, so to speak, right? You only get one, you're locked into it the whole turn. This does not provide very good stats. So there's a lot riding on that gamble. To a certain extent, I think if you're at least looking at this in something like Conclave, where you're pushing heavy on maesters, are you likely to be in a spot where you need to cancel your opponent's reset? I mean, that's normally the kind of eye in the pie idea, right? Is to cancel their reset so they can't even get back into the game once you've got that edge. But I don't know if the Maester character base is the sort of character base you need to protect from that sort of eventuality, or that will even get you into that dominant board position that wants to stop a reset and then just keep trucking. So then I'm looking at maybe some utility plots, a draw plot. I don't know.
Draw plots, I mean, I think draw plots are legit. Like, canceling someone's counting commerce?
Oh, yeah. Even an exchange.
I think canceling... There are three targets you want to hit. I think the priority is reset. And I think it's almost always to your advantage to cancel your opponent's reset, even if your board's not, like, out of control amazing, right? Because they're flipping their reset for a reason.
Sure, sure.
Right. You know, even if it's for, like, a moderate amount of advantage, well, you've just taken away their moderate amount of advantage, unless it's, like, their sixth plot that they don't want to pin, and that's why they flipped it, you're still getting a significant advantage because they just, you know, used their plot slot, and the only, like, reset with decent stats is Valor D'Harris. And, you know, it's still a huge, huge hit for them. There's always a reason why they flip their reset, right? And I think the ability to cancel their draw is also really powerful. That's sort of like the B, you know, the A minus B territory of this. And then I think, like, the econ plot, the one revealed, like, canceling someone's trade routes is very powerful.
Trade routes, too. One of the real big upsides I was starting to think of.
And then, like, Force March is another one that's really powerful. At the Gates is another one. Like, you know, that's often the first turn. But, like, hitting, like, an air. Like, again, like, almost all of the when... Like, here's the thing. I think that 3-0-1 is pretty garbagey. But you... I think I'm just looking at a plot deck, and I'm looking for when reveals.
I was going to go look at some of mine and, so there's, and see how many.
Okay,
I've
this
gotten.
One. Okay, so there's 1, 2, 3. So of this plot deck that I'm looking at right now, 6 of the 7 plots could be canceled, and all of them would get you some kind of advantage, like of either of the Valors, a trade routes, an exchange, a building orders. All those could be canceled. And they would all be to your advantage. Like 4-1-1 blank for building orders? Like with, I guess, what? Building orders has 7 reserve, I think?
Yes. Yes.
7 reserve? That's like, that's garbage. Like, why would you do that? Exchange is even worse. 3-4-4-1? Like, trade routes? 2-2-2-1? Like, it's just like, I actually think that at this point, like, like, we can go into, like, what? Let me go in real quick to Wama's deck that won UK Nationals real quick. All right, so let's look at this real quick. So we've got City Besieged. That's a when revealed. Awesome to cancel. At the Gates, when revealed. Awesome to cancel. Air, awesome to cancel. Marched, awesome to cancel. Nothing Burns Like the Cold, awesome to cancel. Return to the Fields, awesome to cancel. Battle of Margulis, awesome to cancel. So if you outwit literally any of the UK national winning deck plots, you are in a good spot. Like, are there any of those plots, Will, that you would be sad to cancel?
No, probably not. Probably like, not.
I think that, you know, maybe this will shift. Maybe outwit is so busted that it reshapes the meta and people start looking towards having more plots that have sort of passive effects. And that's good in the sense that that means that the meta is shifting around a card, right? And some of these busted plots start having, like, air, start having, like, real drawbacks, right? And have additional you have additional answers to them in the meta. And Conclave, like, we need a reason to play Conclave. I mean, we don't, but we do.
I mean, yes, we do.
Right. And so I think that this is an A plot. I think that Outwit is good. Like, if you can build it, it is a high deck building cost to build your deck around this plot, but it unlocks such a powerful effect that I think it's worth it. And it makes up for it sort of makes some of the other minor advantages of Conclave, for example, like those toolboxy maesters that you get, you know, actually a little bit more attractive. So now I get this busted card plus these minor upside and the whatever upside that the agenda's kind of like fake draw effect offers you, which no one really like can agree like how good or bad that is. you know, Brad Eamon would say it's amazing. Other people would say it's garbage. So, you know, we'll sell somewhere in the middle. Like all those incidental benefits look a lot better. So, and then like, I think you could just build a Stark deck that runs Outwit. I think you could build, maybe even build a Greyjoy deck that or a Barra deck that runs Outwit. You know, like Krayson is extremely playable. Pylos is, you know, like not great, but you know, he's a 3-cost high strength stealth on power.
Like, he's got stealth.
Like, and then like if you're in Conclave, like the number of playable maesters is going up. So I would not be surprised to see this card see some play, because it is such a powerful effect.
Yeah. I actually am tentatively glad to see it in the environment. It's one of those kind of honesty sort of pressure valves to maybe pull in to rein in some of those other plots, like you were saying. But I think it does so in a more fair way than some other cards that fill similar roles. This is a way you've really got to commit to, and it rewards some really strong play or potentially forcing your opponent to play a plot of your choice thanks to Trixie Berg, right? Is that going to finally see play again? Yep.
Yeah. Maybe. I mean, that card still has some some issues.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I think overall I'm going to be a little lower on Outwit because of that deck cost. I think I'm going to give it a plus.
Fair. All right, give us the next plot, Will.
All right. Well, this is another one that I think is going to be in a lot of places, and it's one that Outwit won't hit. This is Siege Preparation. It's 3-1-1, 6 reserve, Siege, and then Dominance action, draw cards until your hand size is equal to your reserve value. Limit once per phase. I don't know 100% if it's busted. I mean, the same argument I made with Hollow Hill, I think, applies here in that Dominance is real late in the turn to draw cards. And I'm stuck with a middling at best. Okay, let's be honest. Low, like, poorly statted plot until then. And I don't even have the benefit, like Outwit does, of making sure my opponent's plot is effectively blank for the turn as well. So that worries me. It's going to have to be a slower deck that can kind of stall things out for a turn with what it already had on the board, and then want to go ahead and fill things back up. I mean, conveniently, Martell does that well and wants all of the above, and has several plus reserve effects in faction. So I think there's definitely something to be said there.
I think it also something to be said in Targaryen. I think this is Targaryen's like marine replacement. Like, because think about like just playing your burn events all out in a turn, or playing those like discard heavy targ effects and being down to like one card in your hand or two cards in your hand, and you've done things in the challenges phase with those effects, and then drawing back up, drawing 4 cards, and then refilling yourself to go into the next turn, right? Like, I think that that's where it's going to be strong. It's going to be strong in a deck that has a lot of ways to empty its hand in the challenges phase, like through events, through ambush, that, you know, is going to make sure that the game goes its way and then wants to redraw back in. So like factions like Targaryen, I think Martell is a good call.
Gotcha.
Are definitely ones you would go to. And I think you would play this in any 3-2-1 deck. Because this becomes Knights of the Hollow Hill. This becomes a 7 reserve. And that's also a deck that often like needs to like empty its hand and like awkward lays and wants forms of card advantage, and this is a good one, right? And then I think you will also see play in any deck that's running dominance effects. So similar to what we said about Hollow Hill, right? Any deck that's running the Last of the Giants Varus combo wants this, right? Because, you know, you can sit on that Varus in your hand and then draw two or three cards and try to get that the other half of your combo. I think Night's Watch decks that run Mutiny want it as well. Just the ability to draw in the dominance phase and be able to, you know, play out, you know, three cards in the marshalling and the challenges phase and draw an additional three in the dominance and hit that Mutiny is really good. And you want to be able to fill this in. The second was pointed out to me by Wama, it's also really good in decks that run You Win or You Die to go into a turn where you have been at your max reserve. So you played all your cards, you redrew back up to six, and then you go and draw an additional four cards the next turn. So you've churned, you know, up to 10 cards deep in your deck. Going into a two-claim turn is really powerful. So I think Siege Preparations doesn't have as high of a deck-building sort of cost, but I think it encourages deck-building tweaks that can really take advantage of this.
Oh, I'm hoping.
So I would give this like a B plus A.
It is another draw plot.
B plus A minus C.
It has a rating. Higher potential upside even than Counting Coppers. So I hope that pans out. I'm just wary of that dominance.
I mean, for people who like to,
I think so,
to empty their hands, like, this is a great plot. So, anyway. We on to Rationing. So, Rationing is a 5 gold, 5 initiative, 1 claim, 5 reserve, Edict Winter plot. Players cannot trigger reactions to winning or losing challenges. This is a firmly B minus C plus plot. I think it's like really good in builders and other factions that want their opponent to be able to trigger a lot of the stuff. Like if Sea of Blood was still unrestricted, this would just go in a lot of other decks.
For rationing the drop so we could see it in the meta with Sea of Blood for a little bit.
I don't think it's powerful enough to have reined in where Sea of Blood is, unless your deck is like, I think decks that were looking for, like builders is the best example, that was looking for like one more edge over a Sea of Blood deck that had like a solid, not great, but solid Sea of Blood. Like you had a game plan. Like you would, someone flips Sea of Blood against you, you're playing builders. You're like, okay, I know what I need to do. If I do it, I have a chance. If I don't, then I'm done, screwed, and I'm going to lose really quick when they blow my wall up and blow up all my abandoned strongholds. But, you know, like, I know what I need to do to beat this. Like, Rationing would just gives an additional safety valve for that deck, be like, alongside, like, Fortified Position and other, you know, and things like that. So, I think Rationing, you will, and, you know, it's the winter plot, so that, like, turns off things like Winterfell. I think that it's a remarkably, like, utility plot. For decks that want to turn off challenge based effects.
Is this our best added winter plot? Thinking of that? I think it is.
It's up there with like the Steve Simone plot is also really well statted.
Yeah, but, you're right.
But it's up there.
Cold. It's something cold.
Withering cold. So it's like a B C plus-ish, but very, very solid for what it wants to do. What it wants to do, it does really well. Whether your deck wants that...
I think there's going to be some other decks that want this. I think it's a pretty reasonable B. I think there's going to be some shadow builds that are okay with running this to muck up opponent's stuff. particularly in Lannister, but once we have the new agenda actually here in front of us, there may be some other factions running this. But I mean, like, look at Lannister. Like, most of the key stuff I'm trying to do there, aside from maybe poisoned coin, if I'm running that, like, everything else is that strong.
Lannister's getting that busted bounce card that requires you to win the challenge soon.
I might be willing to trade off and muck up my opponent's stuff if I don't have that. I mean, it still gives me access to Robert Strong and Mandon Moore and Cersei and Vowels and the Regent's Guard, you know, all of that type of stuff, and the
fair
strong abilities they have that don't have anything to do with challenges. So I think it could be worth tinkering with.
All fair. All fair. All right. Do you want to tell us about Desperate Attack?
I'll give it a try. Desperate Attack is another plot. 2 gold, 0 initiative, 3. You heard it right. 3 claim, only 4 reserve. It's a war plot. And while you're the defending player, raise the claim value on the attacking player's real plot card by 1. I mean, this is pretty much just like the Shaga dream, right? You stare at that 3 claim, and you stare at that 3 claim, and you have it in your hand, you throw it in a deck, and then you lose horribly, and then you pull it out later when you realize even Shagas can't play this card. Which, you know, honestly, I'm in general, I think, glad about anything with this high claim that would allow you to make all 3 challenges. Could be a problem. I mean, I guess maybe my best hope is something heavy, shadows or ambush to keep things out of... no, not even ambush. Something heavy, shadows, so I keep things both out of play and out of hand so that I'm not losing it to opposing military and intrigue challenges, since my opponent is certainly going to go first and take advantage of their boosted claim. It's a cute gimmick, but I think it is not going to pan out in practice. So I think it's probably a very Shaga enticing team.
Yeah, I think D is right. If this card is played, I don't think it's going to be played in a fair way at all. And I don't think it's going to be very easy to abuse. So I would definitely give this a D, or even close to like an F plus. Like it's pretty bad. Like you like, it's so dangerous that and narrow that, like, why wouldn't you just run any of the other 2 claimers?
Yeah, exactly. One of the other 2 claimers that actually gives you some initiative. It gives you a chance to punch first with your big fist. You get a much bigger fist here, but at the cost of nearly every ability to take advantage of it. So,
correct. Yeah. All right. That brings us to the Hand's Tourney, which is a 5-2-1-7 Kingdom and Summer plot. Forced Interrupt. When claim is applied for a military challenge, apply power claim instead. So I think this is the end of the cycle of these, right?
Well, what?
There's like that. Like there's one that does the. There's a plot that does the intrigue of this, right?
Or, there is.
Right? Isn't there like a? Isn't there a plot that was in one of the boxes that when you win a, you can, or maybe the next one you initiate becomes, like it lets you change. Military claim into intrigue
there,
claim.
Yeah, there was one that lets everybody choose, I think. Gosh, what was it? Now it comes to war? Yeah, now it comes to war. Forced Interrupt. When claim is applied for an intrigue or power challenge, the attacking player may choose to apply military claim instead. I think maybe that's what you're thinking of.
Yeah, it might be what I'm thinking of. You know, I think you have to be playing a very specific knight's build that for this, and I don't really think you want to. Like, I don't really think that, you know, turning 2 challenges into power challenges is worth it for where we are right now in the plot game. So, like, I would give this, like, a C+.
That seems fairly reasonable. I mean, it's another middling stat. I say middling, meaning really actual middle, though I think most people give that a more negative connotation. But stat-wise, it really is kind of in the middle here. They're solid, but not crazy. Just respectable. And it gives kind of an interesting effect. It's probably not a turn one play for a joust deck, unless maybe you really want to protect yourself from military. And I think maybe that's going to be the strongest play in joust, is an opener to protect yourself.
That's fair.
From military.
That's very fair.
You probably don't have anything to steal anyway. If you don't care to kill the something that first turn, maybe it's got grounds. And then in melee, yeah,
it's a very solid dude.
And then in melee, this just gets weird. Just gets weird. I would almost say it's a little busted, but everybody is going to do this because it applies to every player. So it's just a lot of power shuffling all over the board that turn. So I want to watch it, but I don't think it's busted there yet.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Like, I think it's certainly going to create headaches.
Oh, yeah. At the melee table. Oh, yeah. And it's not limited to one per plot deck. But thankfully, multiple players having it out doesn't matter. It'll be the same effectively in the end there. So that's good.
Absolutely. All right. You're going to bring us to the last card.
Here we go. The New Gods. Echoes of one of my favorite melee cards from First Ed, actually. So let's get into it. The New Gods is a 6 gold, 4 initiative, 1 claim, and 4 reserve plot. The 7 trait, and each the 7 character you control does not kneel when declared as an attacker in the first challenge you initiate during the challenges phase. Echoes of that old plot, making your holy characters, give them a military icon and didn't kneel to attack this turn. Just at all.
Right.
Yeah, way more. They've reined this in drastically, and I worry maybe too much? At least too much for, like, the 7 kind of deck. I mean, maybe there's a Fat Cat deck that does want to make some challenges with her. Yeah, I mean, if you're not up against someone that's going to muck her up in the challenge itself, I might not turn that down for a lot of strength.
Yeah.
So gold is very reasonable. That's maybe the biggest thing I like here. Strong gold with a trait that does not get hit by me.
Yeah, but it has 4 initiative. Or not 4 initiative, 4 reserve, excuse me. Like, it would be a good opener if it did not have 4 reserve.
It's a world of difference between,
like,
that.
I think his card could have safely. I think this could have safely had 5 initiative or 5 reserve, not 5 initiative.
It could have also safely had 5
because it's, like, not that powerful.
That 1 point of initiative probably didn't bust it.
I mean, it's not that powerful of an effect. The 7 current, as this current strategy, promotes grindier, controllier. Like on the controller end of mid-range decks. And I think that you already have better effects on your plots on this, so this is like a D.
Yeah, yeah. It's if the 7 characters were pushing Renown, Stealth, Insight, Hell, Intimidate even, which might be an interesting flavor direction for them to go, then I would feel like I'm getting some punch out of that, but their characters just don't quite really do that. Poor Fellows, I guess, comes the closest to letting you really get something out of multiple challenges with them. That's all I can really think of. So I want to like it. I wish it was better, but it's probably like a C-. Yeah.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Yeah.
That's the box. The whole box.
Yeah. We did it. It was quite the adventure, but we did it. We got through it.
We did. Oof, quite the adventure. So long. So many cards packed into the boxes. But I like the infusion to the metagame. I like, you know, there are some interesting cards here that I think shake some things up. I like there's some things Absolutely. That are going to push Baratheon, but they push it in new directions. And I think do that better than some of the other boxes. Some of the other boxes we've gotten have just pushed the existing stuff really high, like, say, Martell, I feel, or other... Yeah, Greyjoy. Or others, like, say, Lannister, pushed in new and different directions, but those directions were underpowered for where they needed to be. I feel like the Barra box is much more in line with the power level I want for a box.
I think that this box, it's much more powerful than people are currently crediting it. I think that it's going to end up being remembered as a big influx of power level. I think because it's such a huge... Barra really had nowhere to go but up, and they really pushed Barra in this box. I think more than maybe any other faction, except maybe Martell. And I think we're going to see over... I think these Barra cards are a little bit of sleepers. And so, you know, Barra may end up being a similar situation to kind of where Tyrell was after its box came out, where people didn't realize kind of just like how busted some of the interactions were, like obviously Mace being it, that sort of it took like 4 months before people realized like, oh my God, Mace is the real deal.
Yeah.
And I think that you see that with Barra. And then, of course, there's just some neutral cards that will immediately have an impact, like Siege Prep, like Outwit, like the Agenda. That and Hollow Hill that I think are just going to immediately just reshape the meta. And yeah, I think this box is really powerful. And I think that people are sleeping. If you don't think it's really powerful, you're sleeping on just how impactful it's going to end up being. Now, people are going to be like, well, Stark's still the best. And that's true. But the meta is definitely changing a lot. And I do think that this Barra box provides answers to Stark that maybe we can talk about in a future episode.
I think that'll be great. Well, props and slops.
Absolutely. So yeah. I guess I'll go first. So I want a prop being married. You know, I think we joked about this at the beginning of the episode, but, you know, I think the first box episode ended up being recorded like as my last episode before I left, just because the way the timing worked out. And then... this is my first episode since I came back from my wedding hiatus. So yeah, being married is awesome. I love my wife. I appreciate all the good thoughts and good wishes that I got from my friends in the community or acquaintances in the community or fellow community members. I felt very loved by all the social media messages, and I really appreciate that. And I want to thank everybody for sending them. And there you just might have heard my wife.
I think Ala deserves huge props. I mean, at the moment, I'm being shallow and saying that she deserves them for letting you to devote a massive amount of time to this box review. But as well, she seems to be a lovely companion, helpmate, and wife to you, Roy. So I wish you both the best.
She is definitely the best person I know. But yes, and all the props to my lovely wife, and props to my fellow White Book co-hosts that were able to come to my wedding, and it was just a magical day.
Good. They deserve to be.
White.
Well, you know, I wanted to let you go first, But then I realize in retrospect that despite that feeling like the right and honorable thing to do, that pretty much anything that I prop or slop after that feels really shallow. So.
No.
Well, okay, I mean, a little bit. Because I do want to prop the U.S. women's national soccer team for their World Cup debut for 2019 earlier this week, where they just absolutely crushed Thailand. I've never seen anything quite like it, and I was so torn emotionally on riding that high of my favorite sports team debuting so strongly on another year that I want them to take the title, and yet also feeling really bad for the other team and their fans, and slops to whoever was running the camera for Fox Sports that kept showing a small Thai child crying. You know, on the one hand, it was very evocative of what was happening for a 13-0 game. But on the other hand, half a dozen illustrations of that same child crying is kind of a weird emotional message to send during a sporting event. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's the thing that someone did.
Yeah.
They probably should have done.
Yeah. That's,
so.
So there we go. I took both the prop and the
prop. I'm going to prop Lucifer. A show Alla and I started we went on like a crime show kick for a while. We watched what was the name of the French show that got us there? Oh, Blank Spot on Netflix. Oh, I think that's what it called.
I have not heard of that one.
It's a French a Belgian French show that's like it's a crime procedural that's also got a supernatural twist to it that we watched together, and that kind of led me to being like, I'm finally just gonna bite the dust, because I was in a procedural mood and started watching Lucifer, and it's really bad, but bad in a really enjoyable way. Like, it's the enjoyable kind of bad. It's very charming in its terribleness, and I would recommend it for people who are looking for like real escapist low stakes garbage to watch, which is that's my TV safe space. So it hits the right level of like understanding its lane, staying in its lane, and doing that lane as bad as well as you could expect. So
okay, did you by chance read the at this point old Mike Carey Vertigo comic?
Yeah. Okay. Oh yes, I'm a big admirer of that comic. It's one of my favorite ultra serious comics.
Some of what I love about Vertigo and what makes me so mortified at the potential shutdown of Vertigo imprint.
Well, Vertigo died when we were in our mid-20s. Like, what Vertigo was in the 90s and early 2000s, sort of in many ways, like, Lucifer was one of the last gasps of that era of Vertigo.
Yeah.
Like, Why Probably. The Last Man?
Well, yeah, I was trying, another one. And Fables, I would say.
Fables. I think, came out roughly the same
time. Yeah, I think Fables probably ended last out of that batch.
And should have ended a long, long, long time before it actually ended.
Yeah.
So, like, I think that Fables in many ways, and to a lesser extent where the Sandman franchise has ended up, is really just an argument for, like, why Vertigo really should just be like gracefully, it should have gracefully retired a while ago. I think when Karen Berger left DC, like 5 years ago now, I think
that long ago. That's about right.
That was kind of just like, it was already dying. And that just sort of meant that Vertigo was basically dead. And then Shelley Moore, her natural successor, also left Vertigo, and so like basically
it's so generous that you're saying that both of them left Vertigo. I think right. Were forced out is much more accurate.
Pushed out, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true. Like, I think just Vertigo was dead at that point, and just sort of, like, I mean, I had long ago, like, stopped following what the imprint was putting out, because it just wasn't of the quality that I grew up with, and the, like, what, and just basically also, like, where that comic space is these days is just not where I am, which is totally fine. And so, but just, like, everything I've heard, I've just been like, yeah, I mean, like, it's kind of, to me, like, The Simpsons. Like, it's best to put out of its misery. But, of course, now that Disney owns The Simpsons will never be put out of its misery ever. So, so Vertigo kind of going away, I think, is actually going to end up being good. And we can start really thinking about Vertigo as a historical entity versus, like, as a living comic book imprint.
The perils of getting older. I think we used to love and know is all being destroyed. Damn you, millennials!
Well, I don't think... I guess, actually, one of the things you could certainly blame... No. I don't think you can blame millennials for why Vertigo changed, because all of the writers were... of, I guess, the most recent writers, I guess, of Vertigo would be millennials.
But I can blame some of that on the recent batch and their, let's say, controversies of various stripes, from both the mundane to the considerably less mundane, that led to a batch of potentially solid books not existing anymore, let's say.
Fair. I haven't followed all the drama, so I'm not really in a strong position to comment, but I think way more problems, particularly in the comic book industry, can be blamed on Gen Xers than be blamed on millennials. So, of which you and I are part of the millennial generation.
We are. Thankfully, on the back end of it enough that I still remember a lot of analog things from when I was a kid.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know. Talking about, like, how useless the term millennial is not necessarily something that is, like, great for the white book props and slops section, but I will definitely slop the term millennial. Like, I generally think it is, like, one of, it's similar to, I feel like it's something I've even said on the show, but it might just be something I've said, I just say a lot. Like, I think millennial is in many ways similar to the term hipster, which it doesn't, like, the term hipster doesn't mean anything, and it actually says more about the speaker and what they don't like than it says actually about so-called hipsters that exist. And I definitely think that that is the case of millennials. Millennials and,
I mean,
ascribing characteristics says more about the person and what they don't like about our society and culture. This is anything about people roughly from the age these days, about, like, what, they're Jesse's age, so they're, like, mid to, they're on the later half, the early half of their late 20s, and or the later, the early part of their late 20s to 40-year-olds, because there are 40-year-old millennials now. So, like, in that age cohort, so, like, 25 to 40 year olds, or even if we're being super generous, 30 to 40 year olds, like, when people say millennials, what they really mean is whatever the term they want to come up with for my student.
Well,
age,
I mean, it's the same thing with any of the generational monikers, right? Gen X, baby boomer, silent generation, whatever. They're gross oversimplifications of some, like, generational trends applied to a generation which is always going to have extremely fuzzy boundaries, like, as far as where the age or year cutoff is that I'm at. So, like, it's useful but annoying shorthand, I suppose. But you are, however, entirely correct that us getting into this discussion probably is not great for the white book.
Correct. So what it really did, Will, is it placed us in the danger zone.
It did indeed. That definitely closes this chapter of the white book.